50 years ago today, what many people mark is the start of the modern environmental movement. What is the state of the earth today? That and more coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. During a time of global pandemic, a pause to reflect on the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. Also, testing for coronavirus ramping up in the most populous counties. What's holding back similar gains elsewhere in Texas? How COVID-19 is keeping them down, way down on the dairy farm. And a Texas congressman's claim about a German powder that kills coronavirus. A Politifact fact check on that claim and more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 22nd day of April 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. It was on this date in 1870 that Vladimir Lenin was born, launching a revolution, a new government called the Soviet Union, and a global challenge to Western capitalism that dominated much of the 20th century, known as the Comintern, the Communist International. April 22nd also is the date of the death of the first U.S. president to resign from office. Richard Nixon died on this date in 1994. Both Lenin and Nixon have a tangential connection to the reason today's date is being celebrated by many in Texas and around the world, as today marks the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. Nixon, as many have forgotten, launched the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. And the Lenin connection? Well, for years, detractors of Earth Day claimed that the April 22nd date was chosen in honor of the Bolshevik leader. That wasn't true, of course, but it spoke to the way that even 50 years ago, the modern environmental movement was born amidst an already politicized dialogue. On that Wednesday in 1970, more than 20 million people took to the streets, spurring the passage of environmental laws and regulations still being promulgated in the name of protecting the earth from the effects of its inhabitants. Today, the streets are empty, but the teach-ins are still happening, at least online, sustained by organizations like Dallas-based EarthX. But with a subject as broad as the environment, what can we intelligently say about the state of the Earth on this 50th Earth Day? Catherine Hayhoe is an endowed professor and the director of the Climate Center at Texas Tech University. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We have Jennifer Walker as well. She's deputy director for Texas Water Programs at the National Wildlife Federation. Ms. Walker, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk a little bit about Earth Day 50 years on. There were some really apocalyptic predictions, and millions of people filled streets of cities across the U.S., including big cities in Texas. It was a big news event. These days, Earth Day doesn't get nearly the sort of front page attention that it once did. Let me just open with you, Ms. Hayhoe. How do you see the state of the Earth 50 years on after Earth Day, and do you think Earth Day has made a difference?
Well, when Earth Day was first initiated, it was in response to the massive pollution that we could see with our eyes, the rivers that were choked with pollution, even lighting on fire, the skies that were yellow and orange from pollution. And we have seen massive improvements in those levels of pollution, even though, unfortunately, in recent weeks, we have seen many of those standards starting to be rolled back. Our air is cleaner and our water is cleaner than it was 50 years ago, but the pollution we can't see is much worse than it was 50 years ago. That specifically is the heat-trapping gas emissions. These heat-trapping gas emissions are invisible, but they are building up in the atmosphere, wrapping an extra blanket around the planet, and this is what is driving climate change.
Jennifer Walker, how do you see the environment 50 years after that first Earth Day?
In my experience, the work that we're doing at National Wildlife Federation is that we're really working really hard every day to ensure that we have enough water to support our natural heritage in Texas, to support fish and wildlife habitats in our rivers and keep flowing into Texas's bays and estuaries. And there are lots of different processes working against that outcome.
Much has been made of the change in our behaviors due to quarantine and how you can, for example, pull back and look at satellite maps of visible air pollution and see a visible difference over major cities in the United States and elsewhere. How much of an impact do you think that this current fight against COVID-19 is having on our environment? And is the Earth healing itself faster than one might have expected? I want to ask Catherine Hayhoe that question.
No, I don't think you could say it's healing itself. I think you could say it has a respite, sort of when you're giving birth and you have a respite between your birth cramps. We are seeing that as economic production slows down, as transportation is significantly reduced, there has been a massive drop in air pollution in some of the most polluted areas in the world, bringing blue skies to some areas, the likes of which have not been seen in decades. And that is having a huge positive impact, because what many people don't realize is millions of people die every single year from air pollution from fossil fuels. And somehow, because it's been with us for so long, we've just become inured or even callous to these numbers. So there is a positive impact on people's health, not to say the pandemic is a blessing in any way, shape, or form at all, but it is drawing our attention to the fact that there is another silent killer among us, and that killer is air pollution. Here's the thing, though. As soon as the pandemic passes, our air pollution emissions and our carbon emissions will ramp right back up again because they were not achieved through sustainable means. We advocate for sustainable solutions, for increases in efficiency, for transitions to clean energy that keep the doors open, the lights on, the economy rolling, kids in school, people in work. Those are sustainable solutions.
I want to ask Jennifer Walker about reports that we're seeing about a rise in water consumption. Does that track with what you are seeing right now as the world tries to fight this pandemic?
Well, I haven't really been privy to any water use data, but I do understand that, you know, people are staying home to stay safe. They need to have access to clean water in their homes. There's a lot of anxiety about being able to pay for water bills, to even having access to clean water in their homes in general. Folks shouldn't have to spend their limited resources to go out and try to procure bottled water and risk exposing themselves. I think it's really important that everybody have access to water, whether their use is going up or not. I'm sure it is in my house. We're here all day. There's a couple things that Texas is doing that I think are good. The Public Utility Commission has ordered a moratorium on water, sewer, and power cutoffs for people who have lost their jobs due to COVID, as we're in this unprecedented time with so many stressors. Water shouldn't be one of them.
Talking about the sustainability of some of these changes that we're experiencing, question, of course, is whether or not this pandemic and our efforts to try to deal with it can provide an opportunity to move closer to, say, a greener economy. There's been a lot of attention focused on the decline in oil prices, for example. On the one hand, it's possible that cheaper gasoline prices eventually will mean more people doing a lot more driving. On the other hand, is it not possible that what we'll see is a transition in our economy, that this will be seen as an opportunity to make a turn to renewable energy? I'd be interested in either of your thoughts on that issue.
Well, what we're seeing today is we are seeing incredible falls in oil prices like nobody probably anticipated or even imagined. And we are seeing the bottom just fall out today in a way that is going to devastate many people's livelihoods right here in Texas. But there are other ways to get energy, and we here in Texas are leaders in it. We have already seen wind energy prices go negative on a pretty regular basis on windy nights because we produce so much of it. We're up to almost 20% of our electricity from wind on the ERCOT grid, and we're doubling our solar production year by year by year. So we don't just know the energy of the past, we know the energy of the future. And this really is a turning point, I think, for all of us here in Texas and the United States and beyond to say, what are some choices we could make to insulate our economy so that we are more resilient for the shocks and disasters that will come? Because although we don't know when they'll come, we don't know what they'll look like, we do know that they will come again in the future.
Jennifer Walker, what do you see changing as a result of what we're experiencing right now, long term?
Well, I think that COVID illustrates the need to take a long-term holistic approach and that we can't plan and act as if we're separate from the environment. On the waterfront, without a holistic planning effort, we risk throwing our systems out of balance and creating problems. We need to really plan and act as if the needs of both people and natural ecosystems are paramount. You mentioned lower gas and oil prices. One of the things that we see happening is that there's going to be economic belt tightening here in Texas. Mm-hmm. There's a tendency when this happens for environmental programs to get cut. So these types of decisions are short-term cures, and we're concerned that it undermines forward-looking programs. But the bottom line is we can't act as if we're separate from the environment anymore.
Of course, Earth Day is going digital this year, but I'm wondering if there's not a bigger question about Earth Day 50 years on. How do you think people in general are responding to calls for greater attention to the world that we live in and environmental stewardship?
Well, so many people feel that to care about issues like pollution or climate change, we have to be a certain type of person. We have to be a tree hugger or an environmentalist or a liberal or a socialist or even a communist. But the reality is, to care about our home, we only have to be one thing, and that is a human living on this earth. And it just makes sense for the sake of our health, our safety, our resources, our economy, our families, national security. It just makes sense to ensure that this planet can continue to provide a safe home for all of us.
Jennifer?
I really enjoy, even more so now that we've been staying home for so many weeks, the tradition of spending Earth Day out in nature somewhere and enjoying it and really trying to get immersed in nature. And I think that it's definitely evolved over time, but I think it's more of an everyday consciousness now. And it really, frankly, has to be to really be impactful.
Jennifer Walker is Deputy Director for Texas Water Programs at the National Wildlife Federation. Catherine Hayhoe is an endowed professor and the Director of the Climate Center at Texas Tech University. Thank you both so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Wells Dunbar is monitoring the talk of Texas on this Earth Day. What are you hearing out there, Wells?
Hi, David. Well, Earth Day in the midst of a global pandemic, certainly
true,
making for some interesting comments on social media. On the Texas Standard Facebook page, Janice Hitchcock notes, "Today is my second grandson's fifth birthday. For me, this is a reminder that protecting the environment for my grandchildren and their future children isn't merely something to pay lip service to one day out of the year. It's the most sacred of duties." And Melissa Phillips notes that due to social distancing and shelter in place, we're seeing less air pollution worldwide, more people walking and enjoying the outdoors. I can't think of a better 50th Earth Day for the planet, even if it's not so much fun for the people. Well, in more pandemic news, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick putting himself back in the COVID-19 conversation, arguing that businesses need to reopen in Texas and across the nation, saying that there are, quote, more important things than living. Lots of folks talking about that one. I'll be back with more later in the show.
We'd love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. Our social media editor will be back on the big broadcast in about 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We've been hearing a lot about how important testing is to get the pandemic under control. Texas's most populous county, Harris County, now has 19 testing sites, in large part because of support from the federal government. But as Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider found out, testing in more rural Texas counties has been coming up short.
Chambers County, east of Houston, has a population of just over 42,000. It's been trying to set up a testing site of its own, but it hasn't been able to get the supplies from the Texas Department of State Health Services.
The county had requested 1,000 test kits. They've also tried to obtain these through local vendors and normal sources.
Ryan Holzapfel is Chambers County's fire marshal and chief spokesman.
And so far, they've only been able to obtain 5 of these test kits through the state. And so until they can get them, they can't offer any testing site where persons can come through and get tested for free.
That leaves the options of driving dozens of miles into Harris County to a free testing site or going to a doctor where they can pay to take a test.
The health department informed me that there are people that are suspected of having COVID-19 right now that are staying at home because they can't afford to be tested. It is felt that the numbers of citizens infected are actually higher than what's being reported.
The situation isn't much better in Waller County to the west of Houston.
We have a population of 55,000, and I can honestly say we have probably less than 5 primary care doctors in the entire county.
County Judge Trey Duhon says most of his residents will drive to Katy or Cypress for treatment, but with COVID-19, they're desperate for something closer to home. Duhon says he's asked the state health department for the resources to set up a testing site in Waller County, but he's been turned down, and he says he's not the only one.
I've had conversations with just about all the judges next to Waller County. Most of those counties don't have testing sites as well. So I know I'm not here thinking that Waller County is being singled out.
A Texas Health Department spokesman told us that the state doesn't have the capability to set up testing sites on its own. It's leaving that in the hands of FEMA, which is concentrating on the major metropolitan areas. That's why it hasn't set up a site in Waller County. The department also says it sent Chambers County 135 test kits, not just 5, though it acknowledges that's not a lot. Still, there are some smaller counties that are managing well. Austin County, Greater Houston's smallest, just west of Waller, has set up its own drive-through testing site at the Belleville Medical Center.
Our local hospital coordinated the testing, and they've taken all that on by themselves. And they've been doing it 3 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I believe from 9 in the morning until 1 p.m.
Tim Lapham is Austin County Judge.
Belleville Hospital serves more than just Austin County, but we're still at 12 total positive cases for Austin County, and I believe as of now, 4 of those are in the recovered status.
Belleville has been getting its test kits largely from a private supplier, CPL, rather than the state, which takes much longer to provide them. If there's one other area in which Chambers, Waller, and Austin counties all have something in common, it's that each reports a small but growing tendency towards pushback against restrictions related to the coronavirus. Residents want to live, but they also want to be able to make a living. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a health and safety-focused workers' compensation provider, reminding Texans that the best way to stick together right now is to stay apart. More at texasmutual.com/coronavirus.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The past few years have been tough for U.S. dairy farmers. Dairy consumption is down, milk especially. But in Texas, dairy is on the rise. Over the past 5 years, the state's dairy herd has increased by over 100,000 cows. The industry's grown here because of good weather, affordable land, and a business-friendly climate. But that growth and the livelihood of those in the industry is under pressure from the pandemic. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks has more.
Producing milk isn't the problem for Texas dairy farmers. If anything, that is the problem.
You know, it's just hard to shut these cows off. It's not like a factory that you can turn the switch off today and you're not producing tomorrow.
That's Mark Sustair, a dairy farmer in Hopkins County, about 90 miles northeast of Dallas. Sorry if the sound quality isn't perfect here. He had to do part of this interview from his tractor.
We are right in the middle of silage harvesting. And I was getting behind, so I had to get back on the tractor and get back to work.
Sustair grew up in the dairy business. These days, his herd fluctuates between 450 and 500 cows. And every day, pandemic or otherwise, all those cows have to be milked.
We're dealing with live animals. They've still got to be taken care of. They've got to be fed. And it's not an easy fix.
The problem is that the pandemic has completely warped the normal demand for dairy. Like most commercial dairies, Sustair sells his milk through a co-op. The co-op then sells it to various processors. Each processor uses the milk differently. Some of them might turn it into products there's still demand for, say pasteurized gallons of milk or ice cream for grocery stores. But other processors might normally turn Sustair's milk into butter for restaurants, creamer for hotels, pints of 2% for schools. Thanks to the coronavirus, demand for those has tanked. but the facilities that make them aren't designed to do anything else.
Changing up how these plants operate is not an overnight deal.
So Sustair is producing the same amount of milk as he was before COVID-19, except now there's very little demand for some of its uses. The result is a big hit to his bottom line. There's not much he can do about it.
When milk leaves the farm, producers don't even know what price they're going to be getting for that milk.
That's Barbara Jones, an assistant professor and director of the Southwest Dairy Center at Tarleton State University in Stephenville. Milk producers get a check once a month from the co-op they sell to. The equation that spits out the number on that check isn't simple.
Milk pricing is the most complicated discussion in the world.
But basically, it accounts for the value of the milk sold minus expenses. Producers never really know exactly how much each month's check will be, but they can make a decent guess. Projecting from current prices, Jones said that next month, most Texas dairies probably won't break even.
It's really a grim outlook for the next few months.
Sustair isn't too optimistic either. Some volatility is expected in the dairy business, but the past few weeks have been historically bad.
I believe everybody's extremely nervous. You're not normally seeing a 40% drop in price over a period of, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. And that's an unprecedented drop.
In other states, dairies are dumping out large quantities of milk because there's nowhere for it to go, or it's not valuable enough to cover the cost of transportation and processing. The decision to dump or not is made by co-ops. Texas has seen some of it, but not a lot. Sustair hasn't had to dump any milk yet, but his neighbors have. Whether more or less Texas milk gets wasted largely depends on demand, which largely depends on getting back to normal.
We all hope that it's a blip on the whole market, but as of everybody, you just don't know.
There may be some relief on the way from the federal government. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced last week it would spend $19 billion to support farmers and ranchers affected by the pandemic, including those who produce dairy. Other than look for that and the monthly milk check, though, there's not a lot Sustair can do. Just wait like the rest of us. In the meantime, his cows will still need to be milked. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas is joining a pilot program that allows participants in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, to purchase groceries online. Governor Greg Abbott announced Tuesday the state had received federal approval to offer the option.
Texas Health and Human Services Commission will implement the pilot program so SNAP recipients can log into their account at yourtexasbenefits.com. For information about this feature, as well as information about available retailer and regions that will be participating.
More than 1.4 million households in Texas receive SNAP benefits. Meanwhile, HEB is extending its business hours due to an improved supply chain and greater product availability. The Texas grocery chain shortened its hours last month to give employees more time to restock shelves amid the coronavirus outbreak. Starting Monday, stores will be open from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Congressman Lloyd Doggett of Austin, along with more than 100 other congressional Democrats, is raising concerns about provisions in the upcoming relief bill that would let states cut their Medicaid programs. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports Doggett is urging leadership in the House and Senate to maintain a law in the legislation that ensures states do not scale back Medicaid services during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Doggett says some Republicans have made repealing maintenance of effort laws a top priority in the next relief package. Maintenance of effort laws basically restrict states from making their Medicaid programs worse, that is, by scaling back who qualifies or by cutting some services. Doggett says it's important that states not cut back Medicaid, especially in Texas, which already has a restrictive program and the highest uninsured rate in the country.
We know that many states are facing financial pressure, and often Medicaid being a major state expenditure becomes a target.
Doggett says cuts to Medicaid disproportionately affect communities of color, which are already the hardest hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Fort Worth Auto Racing Track is working with NASCAR on a plan to host events this summer without an in-person audience, following the backing of Governor Abbott and Mayor Betsy Price. Eddie Gossage is the president and general manager of the Texas Motor Speedway. He says it is strange to prepare for a race without the crowds.
But I think that will be good for the psyche of the American people to be able to tune in and see a live sporting event taking place. I think, not only is it a diversion during this struggle, but it also tells everybody that, hey, things are coming back.
Gossage says they've developed a protocol to ensure the health and safety of all participants in a possible event, from the drivers to TV crews. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Those on the Gulf Coast need no reminding, but for the rest of us, recall that this week marks the 10-year anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster. It was the largest offshore spill in U.S. history, with nearly 5 million barrels of oil polluting the Gulf of Mexico over 87 days. Yesterday, we discussed the economic impact of the event, and on this Earth Day, we turn now to the environmental impact. With Lily Verdone, she is the Director of Freshwater and Marine Programs at the Texas Chapter of the Nature Conservancy. Lily, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
A decade removed from the oil spill, to what extent have the ecosystems of the Gulf rebounded from the catastrophe?
Well, I think that it's more of a bouncing forward than a rebounding. So we're not thinking about how we can bounce back to where we were before, but how we can bounce back into a future that's more sustainable and resilient for both people and nature.
You know, it's interesting because 5 years, on the fifth anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon disaster, I remember reading stories which seemed to have a kind of a common theme, that the Gulf proved to be more resilient than many had feared. Is that part of the story here, or was that overplayed, do you think?
I think it's always part of the story. I mean, nature is extremely resilient. We see that over and over again, especially in places like the Gulf, where it's a hard working body of water and it gets hit by everything from extreme storms to extreme weather and lots of use on the people side of that too. And we're lucky that the Gulf is such an important place and that people care about it and want to invest back into it, and that we've been able to take the over $20 billion in Deep Horizon settlement agreement money and invest that back into the Gulf.
Well, now that's a good question, because British Petroleum, as you mentioned, paid out several billion dollars as part of a settlement after this disaster. How has that money been applied toward environmental restoration? How do you do that?
Well, it's been done in a process that has been, a long time of moving money through. $20 billion is a lot of money to move through the federal government, as you can imagine. And over $16 billion was designated to the Gulf. And right now, about 20% has been spent or spoken for already to date. So there's about $13 billion that's remaining. Although this isn't enough to fix all that was wrong, it's been invested well, and it can really accelerate and has been accelerating the restoration efforts of the Gulf and working hard to leverage other funds to create more of a solid foundation for the Gulf to move forward into.
I think when we hear about restoration efforts, we think, okay, what about a particular species of plant or animal or maybe an area of the Gulf that especially struggled to get back to where it was before the spill? Can you think of any? Do any come to mind?
Oh, definitely. I think first and foremost of oysters. I mean, oysters are these unsung heroes of the Gulf. They contribute tremendously to the economic vitality of the fisheries, both in our nation and in each state of the Gulf. And half of the oysters that are consumed in the United States come from the Gulf Coast region. But there's been a dramatic decline to oysters before the oil spill, and then now with the oil spill, we're able to use some of that funding to really help create more restoration, put more funding back into not only the habitat that the oysters develop into, but also to the fishery to help the economic drive of and develop out the fishery into a more sustainable place for people.
Well, tell us a little bit more about some of the conservation projects in Texas that are underway now as a direct result of the Deepwater Horizon disaster and the settlement.
Sure. Well, an upcoming project, since we're talking about oysters, this spring and now into early summer, we'll be working in Galveston Bay, the Texas chapter of the Nature Conservancy, along with Galveston Bay Foundation and Texas State Parks, are working on a 40-acre oyster reef restoration project that's funded with the Deepwater Horizon oil spill settlement funds. And so that's going to happen. And half of that oyster reef is going to be built that can be harvested for the fisheries. And so people can come in and they can do the commercial harvesting on half of it. And then the other half is going to be protected and it'll serve as a nursery for other oysters around in the area. Another big one is Powderhorn Ranch. So a couple years back, the Nature Conservancy and partners purchased over 17,000 acres of live oak forests, coastal prairies, marshes, and wetlands in Calhoun County, in near Matagorda Bay and San Antonio mm-hmm. Bay. And that mm-hmm. was the biggest settlement fund project and one of the biggest projects of conservation to date in Texas history.
Lily Verdone is Director of Freshwater and Marine Programs at the Texas Chapter of the Nature Conservancy. We've been talking about the environmental impact 10 years on from the BP disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Ms. Verdone, thanks so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In September 1989, the Raps came off a Texas concert hall that is today considered one of the world's finest. Named for a former chairman of the famous data company Perot Systems, Dallas's Morton H. Meyerson Symphony Center is well known for its distinctive I.M. Pei-penned facade. But what makes it truly special is now on 360-degree display in a virtual tour narrated by the building's namesake. KERA's Jerome Weeks has more.
Morton Meyerson was asked in 1979 to lead the committee heading up the creation of a new symphonic hall for Dallas. There was one big problem.
I had no idea what to do. I knew that we had to have an architect and an acoustician, but I knew very little about architecture, and I knew nothing about acoustics.
Asking Meyerson to lead the hall's construction actually made some sense. He's a lifelong student of classical music. At the time, he was also president of EDS, the Electronic Data Processing Company. So he had experience running a major business. But Meyerson was 41. He had no experience with city politics or even a sizable construction project, let alone this kind of project. Like any good systems manager, Meyerson started researching what it would take to build the performance venue the Dallas Symphony needed, a single-purpose concert hall. Not a hall that could also be used for Broadway tours or ballet companies. A classic concert hall, like the Carnegie in New York or Symphony Hall in Boston. Trouble was, no one had built such an acoustically demanding hall in more than a century. No one could spell out for Meyerson what was needed. So he found the next best thing. Meyerson tagged along with the guy coordinating the construction of San Francisco's Louise M. Davies Symphony Hall.
First thing I learned was that this was much more difficult than I had imagined. And I asked, how long would this take? And he said, it took us 10 years, and I'm sure it'll take you 10. And I said, nah, this is Dallas. We're can-do people. We'll do it in 6. Footnote, it took us 10 years.
It took 10 years because of Dallas' bond elections, uproars over the budget, the city's demand for an underground garage, and both the oil bust and the savings and loan scandal that dragged the state's economy down in the 80s. There were also simmering disagreements between architect I.M. Pei and acoustician Russell Johnson. Pei had never designed a concert hall before. Johnson had brilliant but unconventional ideas, and both men were persistent. Meyerson says their last standoff was over the mesh grill that would cover the reverberation chambers. These are the concrete rooms along the top of the hall's sides that can be opened or closed to change the auditorium's resonance. Hay wanted a particular grill design.
And then Russell would say, no, it'll mess up the acoustics. And I said, look, we have the following possibility. You can either solve it or not. If you have solved this problem in the next week, your reward is you get to keep your job. If you don't solve this, I'm going to fire both of you and we will continue on without you. And they solved it on the fifth day.
Even so, Meyerson says, 10 years of negotiations like that did not prepare him for the mad rush of the final month before the hall was set to open in September 1989. They had serious supply chain issues. None of the seats had arrived. All the Italian marble for the lobby floor had not been shipped. The Dallas Symphony was rehearsing while the hall boomed with workers, still hammering and drilling. For one solution, Meyerson turned for help from Robert Crandall, then the president of American Airlines. Meyerson asked whether any empty cargo space on American transatlantic flights could be used to haul the marble tiles from Italy. They could, and they did.
The reason why this story is interesting is there are 1,000 stories just like this in the building of a symphony hall or any large project. And you have to have friends because relationships are more important than money.
The Meyerson opened on time and to acclaim. And speaking of friends, the Symphony Center was given its name because Meyerson's former boss, Ross Perot, agreed to donate $10 million to the project. He attached 2 conditions. The hall needed to be first rate, and it had to be named after Morton H. Meyerson. From Dallas, I'm Jerome Weeks.
You can check out the new virtual tour of the Meyerson Symphony Center for yourself at artandseek.org/Meyerson. Laughter, they say, is the best medicine. That's not just folklore. It's backed by science. Laughter reduces pain and blood sugar, improves job performance, stimulates social connection between people, bringing us closer together. In fact, commentator W.F. Strong has been thinking we could use a bit of a reprieve long about now.
I think we're in need of humor more now than ever before. So I thought I'd share with you this bit of classic Texas folklore. You may well have heard it before, and if you have, I'm sure you won't mind hearing it again. If you haven't heard it, well, you'll have the pleasure of hearing it for the first time. Nothing better than novel humor, providing it's well told, so I'll do my best. A Texas cowboy had just recently moved to Montana. He walked into a bar up there and ordered 3 mugs of draft beer. He took a seat in the back of the room by himself and commenced drinking all 3 beers by taking a sip of each one in a consistent sequence so that he finished them all at the same time. Then he walked back up to the bar and asked the barkeep for 3 more. Well, the bartender, wanting to be helpful, said, "You know, partner, a mug of beer can go a bit flat fairly soon after it's drawn. You can buy 'em 3 at a time if you like, but I can bring 'em out to you 1 at a time to keep 'em cold, fresh, and crisp." The Texan replied, "Well, you see, I do it this way because I have 2 brothers. We were always very close until a few months ago when all, sadly, had to leave Texas for a while because of job transfers. One went to Georgia and the other, sorry to say, New York. We agreed to always drink as I'm doing now to honor our good times together until we can all get back to Texas. So I'm drinking 1 beer for me and 2 for my brothers." The barkeep was touched by the man's custom and pushed 3 mugs of beer over to him and said, "This round's on me." The Texan took a liking to the place. He felt like it was home. He came in there all the time afterwards and always followed his 3 beer tradition. The regulars became aware of it after a while and admired his unique commemoration. Sometimes bar patrons would even hoist a beer up in his direction and offer a toast to the brothers, they'd say. One day the Texan came in and ordered 2 beers, sat down, and began drinking them in turn. Everybody noticed and the bar got quiet, unusually silent. The bartender felt he should say something, so he walked over to the cowboy's table and he said quite sincerely, "I'm sorry about the loss of your brother. Truly sorry I am." The cowboy looked confused a minute and then figured out what the bartender was thinking, and he laughed and he said, "Oh, no, no, nobody died or nothing. It's just, you see, me and my wife, we joined a really strict church last week, and I had to swear off drinking." And then it was the bartender's turn to look confused, and the Texan explained, "Well, That didn't affect my brothers none. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication, University of Texas, RGV. Check out his stories from Texas on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served. Okay, Texas, what's your story? You know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on social media. Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, will be back in just a couple of minutes. Stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose fight against cancer includes telemedicine. At-home, virtual visits with doctors help patients keep appointments while continuing to practice safe social distancing. Learn more at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at RaiseYourHandTexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. U.S. Congressman Louis Gohmert from Tyler, Texas, says that a powder has been developed and is being used in Germany to kill coronavirus. Now, according to Gohmert, this powder, when mixed with water and used as a mist, can kill the virus immediately and for 14 days after. Is that a fact? Here to dig into it, Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American-Statesman. Madeline, good to speak with you again. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
This sounds like excellent news, a powder that can kill coronavirus. Where did Louis Gohmert make this claim?
Right. So Congressman Louis Gohmert said this during a live interview with a local TV station in his district, and he was talking about coronavirus and really hitting every topic under that umbrella. In particular, he was talking about measures that he says some healthcare workers around the world are taking to stay safe. He started talking about a person that he used to know from his district who since moved to Arizona and has started a company producing a product like this one that's being used in Germany, he says. And I think it's best to hear him describe this product in his own words, so we've got some audio.
And anyway, it's being used in Germany as a mist. Healthcare workers go through a misting tent going into the hospital, and it kills the coronavirus completely dead, not only right then, but any time in the next 14 days that the virus touches anything that's been sprayed, it's killed.
Boy, that does sound like a pretty remarkable product right there, a powder that when mixed with water becomes a kind of coronavirus killing mist. I have not heard anything like this before.
No, I had not either. And that's part of the reason that his statement really caught my attention. And there are a few things about it that are particularly interesting when you're talking about something that can kill viruses. He talks about using this product on people. And also he has this claim of a 2-week contact time for this product. And that's a measure that's unique to different disinfectants, and it's the amount of time that a surface needs to stay wet with the product in order for it to be effective. And as far as I've been able to tell, I've been going through the EPA's list of disinfectants. I've spoken with experts at the Pesticide Info Center, and they told me that generally that time that a product is effective ranges from 15 seconds to 15 minutes. So anything longer than that and something up to 2 weeks is pretty much unheard of. At least right now, and that's not to say new products aren't being developed, but it doesn't seem to be on the list of EPA products.
And wait a minute. Now, you said EPA, right? Didn't he say that this was in Germany?
He did say it's in Germany, and I had the pleasure of contacting some health authorities in Germany who got back to me very quickly. And at first, before I even did that, I did some Googling to see if I could find a product like this or news articles about a product like this in Germany. And I reached out to Gohmert's staff, and they did not answer any of my questions looking for more info, because part of the problem here also is that he did not specify like what is actually in this powder, so it's unclear what the chemical makeup is. But when I sent emails to the health officials in Germany, I spoke with people from three different health entities, the Federal Ministry of Health, the German Hospital Association, and the German Society of Hospital Hygiene. And all of them gave me an emphatic no. There's no product like this, no tents like this in use at hospitals in Germany. One said, you know, his statement is nonsense, and another thanked me for sending my question because it gave him something to laugh about right now. So
all things considered, as they say, what is the ruling on Texas Congressman Louie Gohmert's claim about a powder that can kill coronavirus?
So this product he described does not seem to exist and is definitely not in use in hospitals in Germany. So we rated this claim pants on fire.
Pants on fire. That is Congressman Louie Gohmert's claim that a powder is being used in German hospitals to kill coronavirus immediately and for 14 days thereafter. Unfortunately, it appears no such product exists. That ruling from Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas. Madeline, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar is with us once again with more of the talk of Texas. What are they talking about, Wells?
Hey there, David. Well, I mentioned this earlier, generating a lot of discussion. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick playing the provocateur yet again, returning to Fox News' Tucker Carlson program last night to argue that businesses need to reopen in Texas and across the nation. There, he doubled down on previous comments on that program where he said seniors like himself should be prepared to make sacrifices, potentially including their lives, to stave off economic destruction for future generations. So last night, the Light Gov said, quote, "There are more important things than living, and that's saving this country for my children and grandchildren and saving this country for all of us," before adding that, quote, "We've got to take some risks and get back in the game and get this country back up and running." Lots of folks taking exception with that statement, as you might imagine. On our Facebook page, Kelly Sawyer asks if we can expect to see him and his family setting the example by eating out, shopping, and participating in any public events he can attend. "I'll just stay home and watch. Thanks," says Kelly Sawyer there. And this divide, David, you know, mirroring some of what we've seen with these protests at the Capitol and the like, and admittedly, still a relatively fringe position. Most of the polling that I've seen bearing out that the public largely in support of these continued social distancing, shelter in place decrees to prevent the spread of coronavirus. But there is a partisan and an increasing sort of partisan divide in that in those responses. So interesting to see a sort of very, very, like I said, an interesting
mirroring the state of the nation as it once was, right?
Yeah. How do you even
put
it? La
plus change, as they say. Yes.
Exactly. Well, inspired by our talk at the top of the show on this, the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, folks sharing more thoughts with us about the holiday. Interesting one here from Josh Fredman. He notes, "It's an incredibly beautiful world we live in, but if you can't learn to appreciate beautiful things, you won't be able to keep them, neither in your mind nor in the material environment around you." And I share that comment there, David, because it does sort of speak to something that I was speaking to my wife about earlier today. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we all definitely are chomping at the bit to get back out there for life to return to some sense of normalcy, if you will.
Right.
But there are some, you know, remarkable things from this time period for those of us lucky enough to, you know, not be afflicted with disease or be out in the midst of it all the time. Those things like spending more time at home, a sort of slower pace of life. It'll be really fascinating to see if those things will survive the sort of transition out of this period into what we think of as normal going forward. So in beginning to see some interesting conversation around that concept from our friends and listeners.
In the short term, it looks like there are going to be more Texans wearing face masks. The Houston Chronicle is reporting that Harris County is going to be requiring masks in public for 30 days as we near what the statistics tell us is our peak for COVID-19. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but this story and a whole lot more we'll continue to cover at texasstandard.org. We hope you can join us again tomorrow. Till then, I'm David Brown along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the team, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and
and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.